Thank you for attending session 272, titled, Does the LDS Church Do More Harm or More Good? Before we begin, please turn off any cell phones. Please be respectful and attentive. And it's the mission of Sunstone to host thoughtful and respectful dialogue, so please keep in mind that when engaging in the Q&A portion of the session, following the remarks, or please keep that in mind when engaging in the Q&A portion of this session. Those who can't abide by that should please refrain from commenting, and you'll be asked to leave if you get disruptive. This session is being recorded, and you will be able to purchase it after the presentation ends. Take advantage of our symposium special by subscribing to Sunstone Magazine, buy things, et cetera, et cetera. Session is 90 minutes long, and we ask both audience and presenters to keep within the framework of that time so we can allow the next session to start on time. I will smack you down if you go over 15 minutes. I'll give you a two-minute grace period, but if you hit 17, I'll cut you off because I want to make sure we leave some time for crosstalk and questions. And as a courtesy to other presenters and our attendees, we ask that immediately after the session you clear the room and speak outside rather than lingering here in the room. All right, with all that out of the way, Joseph Smith famously said, and as Bruce Van Orden just pointed out, it was actually W.W. Phelps ghostwriting for Joseph Smith, but nevertheless, that Mormon means more good. Does the Mormon Church live up to the name, or does it do more harm than good? That's the question that we're here to answer today. And we've got a wonderful panel of social scientists over here who are going to bring actual data and research to the table to help us answer this question. For the sake of the discussion, we're going to bracket the question of eternal life and faith claims, and we're going to focus on measurable social harms and social benefits of Mormon fellowship and practice. I think mostly we're going to focus on the Utah Church. So our wonderful presenters today are Stephen Cranny will go first. He's a postdoctoral researcher at Baylor University, and his research interests include the social psychology of religion, sexuality, and fertility. And Stephen is going to give us some excellent hard data. I've already got a preview of his presentation. He's got all kinds of wonderful numbers for us and to just help us nail down this argument. Ryan T. Cragen will come next. Ryan is an associate professor of sociology at the University of Tampa. He is the guy who has done a lot of the research that is going to be cited today. He's published lots of great studies on this very subject. His research focuses on Mormonism and the non-religious, and he's a numbers guy, but he's done an excellent job of boiling down his numbers to some great visualizations and some forceful and funny common sense arguments. So look forward to that. John DeLynn probably requires no introduction, but I'm going to introduce him anyway. He's famous as the founder of Mormon Stories, and he also has a PhD in clinical and counseling psychology from Utah State University. Recently completed a dissertation that has a lot of relevance to this panel. And then our final presenter is Misha McGriggs, who is a PhD candidate in counseling psychology at Brigham Young University. Her academic research focuses on multicultural sensitivity in psychology, and she's also done lots of great research on colonialism and imperialism, and she's going to help bring a global perspective to our discussion today. And so without further ado, I give you Stephen Cranny.
Do the clicker or something. Or just, okay, that's fine. Cool. So does the LDS Church do more harm or more good? So the way this question was framed, it kind of sounded like a utilitarian question.
I do have a clicker.
Oh, okay.
I think this means I win the debate.
I concede.
Awesome.
Okay, let's make sure it works.
And you can actually unhook that microphone if you want to move around with it.
Ooh. Yeah, it's working.
All right. Yeah. So it sounds like a... Okay. We good?
Yeah, you can.
All right. Okay, so it's kind of a utilitarian question, right? So utilitarianism asks whether something is good or not depends on whether it produces more benefit, pleasure, happiness, what have you, than pain, suffering, misery. So this is a question of does the LDS Church contribute to more utility or happiness or however you want to phrase that than it takes away? Theoretically, just to start from one premise that I think is kind of not that controversial, Mormons tend to be more religious, so all things being equal, Mormons would, because they're more religious, get these generic religious benefits, right? So in general, religiosity is associated with health and happiness or subjective well-being, more technically. Now, this is a huge literature about which dimensions of a religion are associated with which dimensions of well-being or health. But in general, usually when you stick in religion, it's a positive effect. Again, there are exceptions. Schizophrenia is positively associated with religiosity, negative religious coping, things like that. But for the most part, if you stick in a general measure of happiness or health and you stick in religion, it's a positive association. So given that Mormons tend to be more religious, we would expect, all things being equal, again, that Mormons would derive these benefits. Again, just some quotes. I'm kind of using the appeal to authority logical fallacy here. Usually don't just cite experts and say, now it's finished. But like I said, this is a huge literature. So for the sake of time, I'm just going to include two quotes here. Two prominent happiness scholars in the field, Carol Graham and Ed Diener. Incidentally, Ed Diener was just recently hired here at the University of Utah. Carol Graham, a number of studies, including this paper, find that religious people are happier than non-religious ones. In many places, religion has a spillover effect for the non-religious. And Ed Diener, many studies find that religious people on average are happier, but since not all religious people are happier, and not all religious beliefs seem to lead to happiness, we have to search for the active ingredient and what aspect of religion might increase feelings of well-being. So as you'll see, it's kind of hard to find studies that say, are Mormons happier, are Mormons healthier? Usually academics aren't concerned with winning these, you know, fights about whose paradigm is superior. It's usually they're looking for the mechanisms involved, right? What is the active ingredient, right? So again, this comes up because when you look for studies that compare Mormons to other people, there aren't nearly as many of those studies. One, because Mormons aren't that big of a group, and two, because they're not looking for comparisons. They're looking for what is the active ingredient, right? Let's see. So just real quick, this slide wasn't in the one I sent you. Sorry, I just had this thought at the last second. Went through the Oxford Handbook of Health and Religion. Like I said, this is a huge literature. If you are interested in knowing about the relationship between health and religion, you can read all 800 pages of this, and it gets into agonizing detail. So I just looked up Mormon in the index, and I saw all studies that dealt with differences between Mormons and others. So according, it was 2001, there's a later 2010 version. I didn't have access to it at the time when I thought of this, so go look at that. Mormons report lower cardiovascular disease, lower cervical cancer, cancer mortality, greater life satisfaction, lower suicidal ideation, alcohol and marijuana use, and lower completed suicides. Again, this is 2001. Maybe things have changed. So I also decided to, there are three big data sets that I can think of that have a lot of Mormons in them. So I thought it'd be fun to kind of do very preliminary, what's the relationship between these different measures of well-being and being Mormon? What are the differences? So one is the general social survey that I use here. It's a survey that's taken of a couple thousand people every year, and it's been taken just about every year from like 1974 or something to today. So in the aggregate, you have, you know, like 50,000 people or something. So in that big group, you're going to get a number of Mormons. So I looked at the general social survey, and I looked at, okay, so how does being Mormon relate to these different measures of well-being? Again, this is very shooting from the hip statistically. I'm just throwing in basic control variables, so I'm holding some things equal. Again, basic demographics, race, age, education, income. I also included, so general social survey is awesome because it has what religion were you at the age of 16 and what religion are you currently, right? So from this, I was able to derive an ex-Mormon category. Now, I think this is important because you can show that Mormons score higher on these different measures, but there's the question of, do they score higher on these at a cost of people who maybe didn't conform or weren't part of the in-group? Maybe it was at the cost of their suffering, right? So maybe the utility gain for Mormons is the utility loss for ex-Mormons. So I threw in an ex-Mormon category just to kind of see. And as you can see, so happiness, this is a single item measure. How happy are you? One, not very happy. Five, I think it's four is the highest, extremely happy. Being Mormon, you get 1/10 of a point higher on that. Ex-Mormon, there's no effect. Ex-Mormons are no happier or no less happy than the baseline U.S. population. And then I included religiosity, because like I said, religiosity has, as you can see down here,
I should explain first of all, if there's a star next to it, that means it's statistically significant, which means there is a difference. We can statistically say there is a difference. So Mormon, there's a difference, because there's three stars, so it's very significant. But then, like I said, Mormons also get this generic religiosity effect. So maybe Mormons are happier or whatever just because they're more religious. So I included a religiosity measure. This is self-rated religiosity. And it is also significant, as you can see. So more religious are happier. But the Mormon category still remains significant. I included satisfaction with family life. That's significant. Once you include religiosity, it goes into insignificance, barely. So Mormons, once you control for how often they go to church, aren't any more or less satisfied with their family life. They are more satisfied with their marriage once you control for religiosity. And there's a question that measures sense of purpose in the general social survey. Basically, to what extent do you agree with the nihilistic statement that they present? And Mormons also score higher on that, even when you control for religiosity. So you need to show what's significant. You need to show what wasn't significant. So I'll do that. No results. Mormons aren't any more satisfied with their jobs than non-Mormons. They aren't any more satisfied with their friends. The health result was no, which was surprising to me. So that means Mormons aren't any healthier.
Oh, thank you. They aren't any healthier. And then education was that they are also not as educated, but there's less of a negative effect on education from Mormon religiosity than non-Mormon religiosity. So that's interesting. There doesn't appear to be any sort of a negative spillover effect for ex-Mormons. When I was kind of thinking about this in my head, the proverbial high priest that's kind of a jerk to people who leave or who don't agree with him kind of came to mind. So people like that can maybe make life a little miserable for people. Anyway, so I thought that might have an effect, but they're no more nor less happy than the baseline population. So. And then there's this other data set, the Utah Behavioral Factor Surveillance System. The state of Utah does this every year to measure health in the state of Utah. And for 2 years, they measured Mormon identification. So this is great because it's got thousands and thousands and thousands of Mormons. So we can do all sorts of other things with it. Again, interestingly, self-rated health, Mormons aren't any healthier. However, they do report lower days of poor mental health. So according to this, Mormons are mentally healthier. And they do report less days of poor physical health once you control for religious attendance. So again, controlled for religious attendance here, it's significant. So again, this actually kind of confirms the GSS. Self-rated health, it looks like Mormons kind of an advantage with maybe some specific things that are relevant to alcohol consumption and things like that. But as far as general measures, there isn't a really strong signal. Mental health, there appears to be something, though. So again, and then because we had so many Mormons, I could look at interactions. So what I was able to do was, okay, so Mormon has, for example, this racial history behind it. So maybe black Mormons don't get the same benefits from Mormonism that white Mormons do. So there's a way to statistically look at that. It's called a moderation, and so I stuck that in there. And the black moderator was not significant, so there's no difference between white Mormons and black Mormons in terms of the benefits, the benefits, again, in terms of mental health from Mormonism. I stuck in Hispanics for an ethnicity, and there is a significant, they do get less benefits for physical health. I don't know why that is. There's this big question in demography called the Hispanic paradox, because recent immigrants from Hispanic countries are actually very healthy compared to non-Hispanics, which is a paradox because people come from low-income situations, have lower health, and anyway, I'm kind of going on. But so it might have something to do with that. I don't know. Limitations. This is U.S.-centric. It's hard to get a large group of Mormons in other countries to do analyses with. So this applies to Utah Mormons. This might be an in-group, out-group thing, too. Mormons are a majority in Utah. That might be part of this. I don't know. Okay, so what about the effect of Mormon Church on non-Mormons, right? So if we establish that Mormons tend to be happier, healthier, for the most part, in certain measures. For sure, it's not less healthy than non-Mormons. What about the Mormon effect? On non-Mormons, if the Mormon church never existed, would things be easier for other people, right? So General Social Survey has a variety of questions about attitudes, about So they have one they ask almost every year about, would you allow a homosexual to speak? This was done in the 1970s, so they still use the term homosexual. So they have to maintain consistency from year to year, so they still use it anyway. Allowing one to speak, allowing a gay author to have a book in the library, supporting same-sex marriage, and willingness to vote for a black or woman president. So again, I kind of did the same analyses here, just threw in basic control variables. The only thing I could find a significant difference was with same-sex marriage. Everything else, it was insignificant. I think one of them was almost significant to like a 0.808 level or something like that. Anyway, so the point I'm trying to get across is this isn't a broad-based... I'm not seeing evidence that the Mormon culture, population, whatever, has this broad-based generic antipathy towards disadvantaged groups, right? So that's not to say that the LDS community does not have a way to go, but remember, we're comparing this against the baseline American population, which definitely also has a long way to go with disadvantaged groups. I'm sure Misha can speak at greater length of this than I can, but a lot of interesting auditing studies, even in Scandinavian and other very developed countries where you usually don't think this is an issue, when somebody submits an application or resume to get hired and they have a black-sounding name on it, like Jamal or something like that, they're much less likely to get a callback. It's actually better to be a white man with a prison record in terms of getting a callback than it is to be a black man without a prison record, right? So I'm just saying that to set up when we're talking about kind of the difference between Mormons and the base population, just to get the point across that the base population isn't some kind of ideal liberal utopia, right? There's obviously big issues there too. So it's a matter of comparison. Another issue, interesting, church statements are often seen as conservative, i.e., you know, e.g. Proclamation of the Family. It can be progressive depending on the background or the context, maybe more traditional settings. When it talks about people being equal partners, it can be kind of a more progressive document. So again, in looking at the sum total of the influence of the Mormon Church, you need to take those things into account as well. And then policy-wise, Mormons are no more or less likely to report high support for the scientific community or scientific research. Again, this is when I controlled for region and year. So Mormons do tend to live in more conservative areas of the United States, so it's kind of hard to disentangle that. But again, I'm not seeing a lot of strong Mormon trends, like I was with how happy or Mormons are compared to these other groups. Volunteering and donations. Hat tip to Ryan for this. He did the groundwork, found that the church donates about 0.7% of its income to charitable things. That's not a lot, obviously, but the fact is the church has a lot of money, so if we're looking at aggregate utility in terms of what the church contributes to the world, a small fraction of a lot of money equals a lot of money equals a lot. So again, just a quick statement from Elder Oaks, you know, about $1.2 billion. So $1.2 billion, and in terms of this utility equation, covering basic needs is pretty huge. So that's a piece of it. No evidence, there's this one study I found, no evidence that, now, if in paying tithing, Latter-day Saints were less likely to, give to charity, then they would kind of crowd out charitable giving, and that might not, $1.2 billion might not matter, because they might just give it to some other group. There's no evidence that that's the case, actually. Mormons give to, not secular necessarily, but non-LDS church-affiliated charities at the same rate that non-Mormons do. So there's no evidence that there's a crowding out effect. So that's kind of $1.2 billion in the bag. Conclusion, the church is a force for good because self-identification with Mormonism is associated with a range of positive benefits. There's no clear empirical evidence that the existence of Mormons decreases subjective well-being for non-Mormons. I should clarify that. Subjective well-being for non-Mormons generally. Obviously, this is Sunstone. We all know people for which bad experiences of the church have decreased subjective well-being individually. Such positions on the big scale are theoretically speculative. Mormons contribute to the community, nation, and world through donations and volunteering, which can be plausibly assumed to increase the total utility. And then the risk you have when you invite a TBM to present at Sunstone is that I'll preach to you. So here we are. We are all searching for happiness. We hope for it. We think we live for it. It is our aim in this life. But do we so live as to enjoy the happiness we so much desire? So I'd encourage you all to read up on the happiness literature. It's been a lot of studies to experiment on your own lives, find what makes you happy. whether you're Mormon, ex-Mormon, ever-Mormon, whatever, and figure out what that is and do it. Thank you very much.
I'm really looking forward to the Q&A because I have a gazillion questions for him. We're going to go after him. Anyway, so my presentation is kind of like the exact opposite of what he just said. Which is kind of interesting. That said, I'm not going to dig specifically into data, which Stephen did. I'm kind of giving a highbrow kind of overview of the research, some of which I'm citing myself, I'm citing some other people, but I'm going to kind of jump through it fast. I know I'm going to get cut off here. So just to clarify, of course, I've been cast in the role of the antagonist today, so I'm arguing that the Mormon Church does more harm than good. That's the role that I was cast in. I don't personally think that the LDS Church is all bad. I'm going to argue that today. Right? That's the position that I was given, so I am going to argue that, but I don't personally think that, so I'll mention that towards the end. My focus, of course, is to talk about the harms, so that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to leave the good to the other panelists, and then I'm going to attack them afterwards in the Q&A. I do like numbers. I'm a numbers guy. I do both types of research, qualitative and quantitative, but I'm going to try and frame this in a numbers perspective, not with specific kind of significance tests, which we'll go after those later, but here's how I'm going to do it. I'm going to use a sliding bar chart, and I hope this makes sense to everybody, just to illustrate kind of this range of harm to good. So what I'm going to have on most of my slides is a bar chart that looks like this, and where it's red, that means it's harm, right? And where it's green, that means it's good. And I'm going to let that slide across as I'm making my arguments as to whether the Mormon Church does more harm or more good. And if it pushes towards the red side, then I'm arguing it's doing more harm. If it's pushing towards the green, I'm arguing that it's doing more good. Does that make sense? Can everybody follow my bar charts? I'm trying to make this simple. Good. Okay, so basically, if it was all green, it would be all good. If it's all red, it's all harm. There's also a second factor, which Stephen did mention kind of towards the end. The Mormon Church doesn't exist in a vacuum, right? Obviously, there's Utah and there's Mormons, but then there are those around there. So we have to think about harm and good, both internal to Mormons, so how much it affects Mormons, and that's going to be my top bar chart here. So the top one is going to be internal harm versus good, but then there's also the harm or good that the Mormon Church might do for those who are not Mormon. Right? So we have to deal with both of those, because obviously it doesn't exist in a vacuum. So we're dealing with basically 15 million Mormons. That's roughly the number that the church gives. We know it's all inflated, but we'll talk about that, right? So that's the 15 million. And then there's the 7 billion, roughly, people outside of the church, right? And we're going to talk about whether it does harm to them as well. So I'm going to deal with both of those, but I'm going to focus mostly on the internal harm that the church does. So everybody following this? So there are two bar charts at the bottom. We're going to hit all of them. All right. I'm going to start from the assumption that it's all good. Technically, my bottom one, the external, is kind of like neutral, right? Because most people aren't affected by the Mormon Church. But I'm just going to start from the assumption that it's all good. And then I'm going to work up and see how far we get, right? So our first harm, I'm actually drawing on a theoretical perspective in the social sciences that I don't personally agree with, but I think it works really well for this argument, which is rational choice theory. From a rational choice standpoint, people will stay Mormon if they think that it benefits them. And they will leave if they think it does more harm, right? So rational choice is you weigh the costs, you weigh the benefits, and you try and maximize benefits and minimize costs. Why would you stay in a religion that is harming you? Therefore, if people are leaving, you can assume the church is doing harm. And if that's the case, right, and we can debate this, and I'm perfectly happy to debate this point, but if we can kind of just go with that, what this seems to suggest, more than 50% of those people who are listed as members in that 15 million, we know don't consider themselves Mormons anymore, right? We've known that, and I'm citing Rick Phillips, a buddy of mine who first published on this. What that means then, right, if we're just thinking about this from a harm versus good standpoint, I think my battery just died. Come on. What happened to that? Oh. Maybe? We're back. There are also hundreds of thousands who have left, right? But if we're thinking about this from a harm versus good standpoint, we can already jump to 50% of that 15 million felt like the church harmed them. They don't identify as Mormon anymore. They're out, right? We know 1 million of that 15 million are people in Brazil who were baptized but no longer self-identify as Mormon. There's a million of the 15 million who are no longer Mormon. They just don't identify as such, which would suggest that for half of the 15 million, the church did more harm than good. There we go. So we're already at half, and that's my first slide. I've got a lot more slides, right? We're going to go fast. All right, so that's my first one. Second one is gender, right? And I don't think this is an argument that's like a hard argument to make, but there are more women than men in the LDS church, particularly here in Utah. It's about a 60-40% ratio, right? And the LDS church's beliefs, teachings, policies, and practices are all detrimental to women. They subordinate women. There's no way that you can argue otherwise to this. Well, if that means that it's at least half, but probably more of the remaining population are women, then we can immediately jump to the LDS Church harms women, and we're already up to 75%. Like, two slides, 75% are harmed by the Mormon Church of the 15 million. It's pretty easy, I think, right? So we'll keep going. We have another type of gender, right? So that's just women. But we also have transgender individuals. The LDS Church doesn't even recognize them. If you've read the church handbook, and I just had a chapter come out on this, the only policy position they have on transgender individuals is if you get surgery, you are excommunicated. That's it. That's the only policy. They don't recognize if you actually trans, if you transform, right? If you make the transition, they don't recognize you. So I don't know how you could argue otherwise that the church is harmful to transgender individuals. It is a cis-normative religion, meaning it favors cisgendered people as opposed to transgender people. That's not a huge percentage of the population. I'm just going to tack on like 1%, right? So we'll just go 1% more is harming them, our transgender Mormons, right? So we know it's harmful to them as well. What about sexual identity? It's a pretty easy one. I'm citing John here. This is actually one of John DeLynn's studies. Crowell, do you know this one? Yeah, he knows this one. The LDS Church marginalizes LGB individuals, lesbians, gays, bisexuals. We know that if you want to stay in, you have to be celibate, which is incredibly harmful, as John's research shows and lots of other research. There's no question about this. The LDS Church is heteronormative. You basically can only stay if you are heterosexual. The church only works for those people. So the LDS Church harms LGB individuals. Estimates on how many there are in the population, right, range from around 3% to 10%. I'm going to go on the low end and just tack on another 2%, right? So we're now up to 2% more are being harmed by the policies, beliefs, and values of the LDS Church. Our next one, sexual and gender identity, external to the church. This is my first one outside of the church. Hopefully we're all aware that the LDS Church has worked and continues to work to marginalize LGBTQ individuals around the world. They are engaged in campaigns all over the world politically to prevent them from getting the same rights as straight people. There's no other way to think about that other than they are harming LGBTQ individuals around the world, and that means that's another 3% externally. That 3% is more than the 15 million combined. That's harm that they're doing to 3% of the world's population, and that's a low estimate, by marginalizing them and keeping them from having the same rights as everybody else. So, again, harm that the LDS Church is doing, right? Race, ethnicity, I debated putting this one in, but I think it's still there and I think it's relevant, right? The LDS Church no longer formally discriminates against racial and ethnic minorities. They've kind of disavowed the policies, right, and the beliefs, but they never really disavowed the doctrine. The doctrine's still there. The Book of Mormon is a racist book. It's a straight-up racist book. It's hard to argue otherwise. If that's the case, well, we can see how that official policy doesn't necessarily translate into equal behavior for racial and ethnic minorities. And we know that increasingly large percentage of the Mormon population, those 15 million, are not here in the U.S. They're outside of the U.S. They're racial and ethnic minorities compared to what we'd have in the U.S. They're not white, right? Which means the LDS Church arguably also harms racial and ethnic individuals. That bumps us up to, what are we at? What's our percentage here? 88%. Right? 88% have been harmed by this. All right, moving on. What about non-traditional families? So the LDS Church has a strong emphasis on nuclear families, and some could certainly argue, oh, this is a great thing. Maybe, unless you're divorced or an adult single person or a single parent or childless by choice, all of those people are marginalized not only by the policies and the practices, but by the very belief system. It's built into the theology of Mormonism that you have to be a nuclear family. Married, right, and straight with kids. It's built into the doctrine, which means everybody who fits these criteria is going to be marginalized by the Mormon Church. They are harmed by the LDS Church. And it turns out that's actually a sizable percentage. Does anybody know what percentage of households in the U.S. today are nuclear households? It's 6%. 6% are traditional nuclear households. It's a tiny fraction. And the Mormon Church marginalizes everybody else. Okay? So we bump this up again. What do we have? We're at 94%. of the members are harmed by the church. Okay? All right, my last one on the harm before we do a summary. You gotta have it, you know, masturbation. So, obviously, the LDS Church condemns masturbation. I do encourage you, if you can find the article, this Malin and Bolliff article is amazing, and it will probably piss you off or make you cry, because it's really, really well written. And they illustrate just the damage that comes from the teachings about masturbation for the Mormon Church. As a result, those who masturbate obviously feel guilt and shame. Do we know what percentage of men report that they masturbate? 96%. The other 4% are probably lying, right? What about for women? It varies, right? Some put it as low as 60, some as high as 80, which me, and those numbers don't vary a whole lot for Mormons. Just so you know, like when we've asked this of Mormons, it doesn't vary a whole lot. So they're masturbating too. And how do they feel? Well, not while they're masturbating, right? How do they feel after they masturbate, right? And this is another great article, so I've given you a Grubbs article. Grubbs article does a great job of illustrating that this idea of porn addiction is almost entirely a social construct created by religions. There is very little evidence that there's anything even akin to porn addiction, but most of the people who say they're addicted to porn are religious, and they're getting that from their religion. It's a beautiful example of a self-fulfilling prophecy, that they tell you, oh, you can get addicted, they believe it, and then they feel that it's actually harming them, and there's no evidence that it actually is. So another good example, the LDS Church harms masturbators, right? There you go. That's going to put us all the way up to, what, 97%. All right, so quick summary so far, just so we've got this, right? LDS Church harms those who have left, women, LGBTQ individuals, internally and externally, racial and ethnic minorities, non-traditional families, and masturbators. Got it? Okay. This leaves cisgendered, so not transgendered, cisgendered, straight, white, married, non-masturbating men with kids. All 15 of them. I mean, how many more are there, right? And I question some of those guys, too. I'm betting they're masturbating as well. All right. So I'm not quite done, right? But we've basically illustrated, like, it harms almost everybody, and I'm actually going to argue that it even harms them, okay? In a subtle way, I think it harms them too, and here's how, right? So to begin with, by teaching their members that everyone should be straight, white, cursed to be a woman, can't be transgendered, must be married, should have kids, and they can't masturbate, they're also teaching that these things are the ideals. So they go around judging everybody who doesn't fit those ideals, which means even those men, right, with kids who are married and apparently aren't masturbating, those men go around judging everybody else saying, you're inferior. And how is that beneficial to them? And then on top of that, what does it actually teach them about treating women? It treats them to be benevolent patriarchs, right? And if you're not familiar with the term, benevolent patriarchy is a great idea when you start to think about, like, oh, maybe women don't need to be protected. But that's exactly how the Mormon Church frames how women should be treated, if they're willing to be subordinated. If women are willing to subordinate themselves to the patriarchy, then we take care of them. We put them on a pedestal. They're separate. They're supposed to be special. When, in fact, that's really not what feminism is all about, right? And, of course, the ones who aren't willing to be subordinated, well, those are nasty feminists who need to be subordinated and converted anyway. So, ultimately, it even harms those patriarchs by teaching them to think about the world from the wrong perspective, non-egalitarian ways, right? I'm going to move fast here. So in short, I would actually argue that the LDS Church harms every member. Because the ideology built into it is non-egalitarian, and it harms everybody who doesn't fit that one tiny little group, right? A couple of other things real quick. How are we doing on time? Are we doing okay? Moving fast. All right, so a couple of things. Of course, the official position of the LDS Church on evolution is we don't have a position, right? We're going to see how that is. But it's implicitly anti-evolution. I think most of us know that. And the data actually bear that out. When you look at things like the General Social Survey, most Mormons actually do not accept evolution, which is kind of interesting. The LDS Church, of course, also teaches its members to take Scripture literally. And there's overwhelming evidence that the Scripture can't be backed up that way. Ultimately, what this leads to is widespread... good, somebody got doTERRA. Widespread anti-scientific and pseudoscientific beliefs. I love coming to Utah. I'm from Utah, right? I love coming to visit family. But one of the things that just, like, blows my mind is driving around and seeing all the chiropractors and the people selling essential oils, right? Like, this is widespread. My dad literally believes that he cured his asthma by pushing on his foot. Foot reflexology. Okay, and I'm not supposed to swear, am I? So, sorry, I do have a filthy mouth, but I'll try and keep it clean because I know I'm not supposed to. But that's crazy. What's the mechanism? By pushing on your foot, you cure your asthma. That's insane. Why are those beliefs so widespread here? Think about it. Because the church teaches people to believe in things that are demonstrably false. They do. And that harms every single one of them. Great quote from our favorite person we love to hate, Boyd K. Packer. No idea has been more destructive of happiness. No philosophy has produced more sorrow, more heartbreak, and mischief. No idea has done more to destroy the family than the idea that we are not the offspring of God. Only advanced animals compelled to yield to every carnal urge. Tell me that the church is not anti-evolution. That's anti-evolution. That's anti-science. They are. They teach it. And it's borne out in the data. We see it, right? Again, every member is harmed by the church. My opiate argument. Mormonism is also a manifestation of Marx's idea that religion is the opiate of the masses. What does Marx mean by this? Well, it keeps people from actually trying to change the world. Because if your reward is when you die, why do you care about what happens here? And how do Mormons stand on this whole issue of climate change? Climate change, pshaw, not a big deal. Jesus is coming. Right? So why do we care about climate change? Even if, you know, humans are causing it, doesn't matter. We can't do anything about it. And Jesus is coming. It's going to save all of us anyway. We actually get great quotes like this. Russell M. Nelson. Some facetiously state that nothing is as permanent as death. Not so the grip of physical death is temporary because it's all about the afterlife. Religion is an opiate for Mormons. And as a result, it keeps them from trying to change the world now. Again, it harms every single member by teaching them, worry about the afterlife, not right now. A couple more, real quick. Am I still doing okay? I think they're liking it, so even if I go over. Sorry, 1 minute. Okay, I'll go fast. Sorry. LDS Church finances are opaque. We have no idea how much money they actually have, but they get massive tax breaks. They own, I live in Florida, they own more than 1% of my state. They're the largest landholder next to the government of the state of Florida. And what are they doing with that? Right? We can talk about that in the Q&A, but no one knows how much money they actually have. They just bought, did anybody catch this, in Irvine, California last week, a $45 million apartment complex. Why? Why does a church that's trying to do this threefold mission, right, why are they buying $45 million apartment complexes? That doesn't make sense to me, but we don't know, right? We also have this one, non-Mormons can't attend their kids' temple weddings. That's harming them, right? So we've got another group that's clearly harmed. If it was your kid and you couldn't go to the wedding, you'd be pissed off too. Right? So those unpaid taxes, they're getting tax breaks for that land they own in Florida. They're harming my kid who goes to the public schools. That's a direct harm that they're doing. That's external. There are also the thousands of alienated parents, so we can bump up our external harm to about 5%. That's a lot of people that they're harming externally, right? What about this some good argument? Sure, they donate some money, but did you know that Walmart is more charitable than the LDS Church? Walmart is more charitable than the LDS Church. Think about that for a second. It's a church. Walmart's not a church. And you may hate Walmart. I don't love Walmart either. They give more money every year than the LDS Church does. Okay, going fast. Anything else that does well? I'm going to skip over some of these. We'll come back to them because these are part of Stephen's things. But I'm going to end on one point. Even if the LDS Church does some good, I have to end on this one because it's kind of terrible, right? But the LDS Church kills people. They kill people. Right? And I know it's horrible to say, but they killed Harry Fisher. And I don't know if you caught this. I've got the citation down here, but they just did a great article. He drove up Israel Canyon just a few months ago and shot himself because he's gay. And he left his Mormon scriptures in the front seat of his car open to this quote, right? This passage. For whosoever will save his life shall lose it, and whosoever will lose his life for my sake shall find it. I would put his body on the steps of the church office building and say, you did that. You did that. I'm going to skip this, but basically, just one person killing themselves tells me that this is a harmful religion, but it's not one person, it's thousands of people. So my wrapping up summary, every Mormon, I would argue, is harmed by Mormon ideology and Mormon teachings and beliefs and practices and policies. Mormons also harm those outside of the church by pushing their beliefs and their values on them and actually pulling taxes away from them. Mormonism also kills people, and I think that's horrible, and we need to just state that, right? So I think it's pretty clear what the conclusion is. Mormonism does more harm than good. Thank you.
And who wants to follow Ryan Cragen in a presentation? Not me. I don't have slides today, which is really rare for me. I'm not a sociologist. I'm a clinical and counseling psychologist. So I'm going to be drawing from the thousands of hours I've spent with my clients and with many of my podcast listeners over the past 11 years to inform this presentation. I'm also going to be drawing a lot from my personal experience, which I'll call emotional data. Is that good?
Sure.
Does that work? That was a joke. I first want to begin by acknowledging my biases. When asked this question about whether I think the church causes more good or harm, there are many aspects of my life that would cause me to want to weigh on the side of harm. I'm pretty open about not believing in the LDS Church's exclusive truth claims. Of course, I have been rejected by the church that I love and have been excommunicated. And as a mental health professional and as a podcaster, I've been exposed to so much suffering. And I'm exposed to it every single day. So there's much in my life that would tug me towards being really hard on the church. On the other hand, anyone who knows me knows that that's not all I'm about. There's so much that I think of very positively about the church, my excommunication and truth claims notwithstanding. I owe my very existence to the church. I'm a pioneer ancestry. I have so many beautiful memories of youth conferences and temple trips and dance festivals and warden stake dances, testimony meetings, and beautiful youth leaders. And I'm sure so many of you have those feelings as well. I have had so many material benefits foisted upon me because of my affiliation with the church, and I'm literally dripping with privilege as a white, heterosexual, cisgendered, married male who masturbates. No, who used to. I have so many. So even as an excommunicated member, my cup of gratitude runneth over for the church. So that leaves me sort of where I like to be, which is one of the plagues of my Mormon life, is that I'm always viewed by believers as being far too critical of the church, and I'm often accused by ex-Mormons as being far too kind on the church. And I'm okay being in the middle. When asked the question whether the church causes more harm or more good, I'm informed by my studies of secular Buddhism with a story about a farmer who wasn't married. He had a son and a horse. And one day the horse fled the stable and ran away. And the neighbor comes up to the old man, the farmer, and says, "This is a terrible day. Your horse is left." And the wise farmer said, "Who knows what is good and what is bad?" The very next day, the horse brings back two female horses that it had found while it was running around. And the neighbor comes back and says, "Wow, what a beautiful day. You now have three horses instead of one." And the wise farmer says, "Who knows what is good and what is bad?" Then the very next day, the son decides that he's going to train these two new horses. And as he's training one of the mares, he's bucked off and breaks his leg. And of course, that pesky neighbor comes back and says, "What a terrible day. Your only son who helps you farm has broken his leg." And the wise farmer says, "Who knows what is good and what is bad?" And then the very next day, the army comes in to conscript young youth for the military. And of course, because the son has a broken leg, he's not carried away to war. And so I don't think anybody here, as brilliant as these people are, I don't think anybody here is really smart enough. And I don't think the entire volume of social science literature gives us enough data to be able to answer this question of whether religion or the LDS Church is, in summary, good or bad. What I will say, my view of civilization is this. I think that 10,000 years ago, our ancestors were living in caves and huts. They were clubbing each other on the head. They were warring each other and very tribal. As a human, as someone who considers himself a humanist, I'm very happy and proud about how we have advanced as a species. Has religion caused incredible harm? Absolutely. But religion has been inextricably linked to our advancement as a species. It provides order, it provides structure, it provides community, it provides protection, it provides identity. In some cases, it provides education and science and arts. Now, of course, it's also fought many of those things as well, so it's complicated. But that's my point. I think that it's way too complicated. So when we ask the question of whether religion is good or harmful, I think we have to ask good or harmful to whom, and good in what way or harmful in what way. And I think Ryan did a really good job of trying to break this out a little bit. Obviously, the most important good that the LDS Church has foisted upon humanity is the fodder that is provided to reality TV shows. Can we all agree? The best reality TV shows have Mormons in them. So that's an unambiguous good. The LDS Church has produced an incredible high volume of good fiction writers. Orson Scott Card, Brandon Mole, Richard Paul Evans, Stephanie Meyer, Shannon Hell, just to name a few. As a gentleman, I will resist the urge to speculate as to why Mormons are so good at writing fiction. Mormons have provided so much to the entertainment industry, music and actors, the Osmonds, Tyler Glenn, Jared Hess, Mindy Gledhill, Aaron Eckhart, Glenn Beck, Amy Adams, Benji Schwimmer, Brandon Flowers, David Archuleta, the Osmonds, I could go on and on. I had a special category for politicians, but then I thought Orrin Hatch, Mitt Romney, and Harry Reid belonged in the category of entertainers just as much as the musicians and actors did. I'm sorry. I actually like Harry Reid. Mormons have been very good at the expansion of the Mormon gene pool. Mormons are very good at populating the earth. And I think we have the average of 3 children per family on average in the United States. And so that's something we're really good at, is producing more Mormons. I will concede the idea that Mormons have higher than average physical health in many instances, lower mortality rates, lower disease rates, higher age expectancies, lower drug and alcohol abuse. We do know that the prescription drug use is very high, and even prescription drug abuse in Utah is very high. So that's something to keep in mind. I would argue that the LDS Church is very good for the material prosperity and education levels of its members, even in developing countries. I remember a Reddit thread about how the perpetual education fund was evil. And then my friend Sammy Galvez made the comment, you know, sometimes you intellectual white Mormons think that you have an understanding of what the world's like. But I'm from Guatemala. I came and I benefited from the perpetual education fund. And don't you tell me that the microloans that I was given didn't help me get a leg up and get a higher education. And so we need to resist the tendency to allow ourselves to call things good that are good. I say the LDS Church is very good for the beautification of downtown Salt Lake City. I think the LDS Church is very good for the bottom line in the balance sheet of the corporation of the president of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, and for businesses connected to top church leaders along with their family members. I think the church is very good in blessing the lives, in all seriousness, blessing the lives of millions of Mormons, providing people with identity and morality, community, meaning, purpose, structure, order, occasionally charitable contributions outside the Mormon community. In summary, I think the Mormon church is world class at taking care of its own, if you fit the mold. And that is where we turn to maybe what I would call the dark side of this equation. The underbelly, we could say. Here are some areas where I think the LDS Church is harmful. I think it's severely limiting to the education levels and perceived potential of many of our young women and middle-aged women and elderly women. I think there's a plague of depression among Mormon women, especially in Utah. I think in the time of the world, where the world is elevating the status of women, including Hillary Clinton and people of color, the LDS Church continues to turn down opportunities to diversify. And instead continues to perpetuate a white, straight, Utah-based patriarchy. I think the LDS Church is a significant force and has been in advancing racist ideology over the past 150-plus years, not just to mention Brigham Young's teachings, which flowed to Joseph Fielding Smith and then Bruce R. McConkie and then infiltrated our own CES curriculum. But I say this hesitantly, but with conviction and a bit of sadness, that I think the Book of Mormon remains one of the most racist mainstream texts, religious or otherwise, in the modern world, given how often it's read and how often it's distributed. Forget every list on Jeremy Reynolds' CES letter. In my view, the racism in the Book of Mormon in and of itself is all that is needed to invalidate it as being of divine origin. And that's my bias. I think the LDS Church continues to colonize and neuter and erase Native cultures across the world, both here and abroad, which is deeply troubling. I'm sure Misha's going to probably touch on that a little more. I think the LDS Church has been very harmful for advancing the civil rights in the United States. We fought the Equal Rights Amendment. We fought the civil rights movement. My cousin Ezra Taft Benson basically said that the civil rights movement was evil. That Martin Luther King Jr. was a spawn of communist Russia, and that we should, you know, and then fought segregation here in the United States. And of course, we know that the LDS Church was instrumental in fighting same-sex marriage. The positive flip side of that being that there's a pretty good argument to be made that they helped accelerate the adoption of same-sex marriage, both through fighting Proposition 8, both through encouraging Proposition 8, and then, of course, through Utah being the first state to accept same-sex marriage officially. Well, not the first, but the first of a cascading sort of series of final states, I'll say. Finally, we claim to have prophets, seers, and revelators, which sets up some really high expectations. But in reality, we as a church have consistently and reliably lagged behind the developed and even the developing world on matters of social justice by 2 or 3 decades. And we can pretty much expect that as being the truth for the foreseeable future. So this is one of the deep ironies of my life. The LDS Church does a really good job sometimes of defending abusers at the expense of the abused. And of course, where my social science research comes in, the LDS Church has been deeply harmful to the LGBT population by teaching these individuals that they are not loved by God, that who they are is not accepted by God, by teaching them that they need to change who they are, if not through a therapist, then through prayer or hyper-religiosity. They continue to encourage indirectly mixed orientation marriages through North Star and Ty Mansfield and other organizations. My research shows that those marriages so often, 70% of the time, end in divorce with children as the collateral damage, many instances, and very low levels of quality of life and high levels of depression, low levels of self-esteem. Celibacy is also a catastrophe for the mental health of those who engage in it. Not to mention, as Ryan mentioned, the epidemic of LGBT homelessness and youth suicide in Utah. I believe that the LDS Church can be very harmful to the mental health of its members, and that's shown, of course, by the high level of prescription drug abuse here in Utah. The messages about sexuality, pornography, and masturbation can also be extremely damaging. The thing that's most confusing and troubling is that the LDS Church seems to have become its own worst enemy. So it's becoming harmful to its own future. And what I mean by that specifically is, on the one hand, it's released these new essays, which are historical, which they claim are signs of a new openness and new transparency. But for many who read those essays, they find that they omit very important details. They provide for many a deceptive contextualization, and they serve more as a tool of propaganda than any means of actually educating or reconciling or atoning for its omissions in the past. So in some ways, it's shooting itself in its own foot. And so many of the transitioning Mormons that I've talked to tell me the essays were the impetus for their transition. How many of you can relate to that? Yeah. In addition, the LDS Church has started in haste over the past few years conducting witch hunts and excommunication courts for members with sincere and legitimate questions and doubts. They're continuing to provide indirect support to apologist organizations who rely too often on smear tactics and misinformation. And in my view, and based on the study of 3,000 post-Mormons that we conducted actually for the church several years ago, what that study showed is that we're pushing out many of our best and our brightest. We're pushing out those that value truth over ignorance, and instead we're holding on to and embracing those who value expediency and comfort. We're pushing out those who value inclusivity and equality so that we can hold on to those, in some cases, who value bigotry. And we are pushing out those who value empathy and love to hold on to those who sometimes value judgment and ridicule of others, even if it's in a private, sometimes passive-aggressive way. So in a church that claims to follow Christ, whose central message was compassion and tolerance and love and mercy and humility and eschewing of material consumption, it has become in many ways the institutional poster child, as far as religions go, for intolerance, for soft, passive-aggressive bigotry, for corporatism, legalism, cronyism, and now, stunningly, a chief proponent of conspicuous material consumption with the City Creek Mall, which is a real irony given the messages in the Book of Mormon. So the LDS Church leadership, in my view, has pushed my former beloved church more towards a church of bureaucrats and businessmen and lawyers and public relations specialists. So where it really gets serious for me is it's one thing to lie and deceive and abuse and to ignore science and evidence. It's another category entirely to do that while claiming God is telling you to do those things. And that's where it gets really serious. It's particularly pernicious to intervene in very serious and personal aspects of one's human life, such as matters of identity and sexuality and race and gender, and to intentionally ignore the information that the social scientists give us, and to meddle in the lives, especially of children and young adults and youth, as they're developing in their lives. So this sounds pretty doom and gloom, but the truth is I'm actually very, very hopeful. Over the past 11 years, I've made so many beautiful friends, thousands of friends, tens of thousands of transitioning and post-Mormons and progressive Mormons. Many of them are here in this room. These are highly intelligent individuals. They have a very high premium on integrity and honesty and service and true community and compassion. I am so inspired by the relationships that I've formed. We have produced many really brilliant and inspiring public figures. Some of you may not know these names. I'm inspired by John Huntsman Jr. I'm inspired by Jim DeBacchus here in Utah. I'm inspired by Mindy Gledhill. I'm inspired by Jared and Jerusha Hesch, Robert and Linda Duncan, Lindsay Hansen Park, Misha McGriggs. I'm inspired by Gina Colvin and John Hamer. I'm inspired by the Mama Dragons. I'm inspired by my homie Tyler Glenn. He has an amazing album coming out, and you think that you've seen some good stuff. It's an amazingly brilliant album, one of the most incredible pop experiences that I've ever been exposed to, and it is very much born out of his Mormon experience. We wouldn't have it without Mormonism. I've developed some of the best relationships of my life. Chris and Steve Holbrook, who've developed the Utah Valley Post-Mormon community of over 1,000 Mormons who get together for picnics and potlucks and karaoke. It's a beautiful community. Don and Mary Mealing, Rick and Holly Alden, Kim and Terry Turner, who have created a group called WACAs, Women's of a Certain Age, and they get all these women who are 40, 50, 60 years old together, and they fellowship each other, and they love each other, and they support each other. There's a couple in this room who was denied the ability to watch their own child's wedding, as Ryan talked about, and Kim and her friends rallied around that family, showed up at the temple, and spent the day at the temple with this couple so that they wouldn't have to hang their heads in shame, and they could rejoice and celebrate their experiences instead of just mourn the fact that they were being excluded by a church that claims to be following Christ. I'm proud of Natasha Helfer Parker and all my associates at the Open Stories Foundation. I am not necessarily hopeful for the corporate LDS church. Aside from all the ways they're poking themselves in the eye, there's a massive wave of secularism in the United States and in the developed Western world where religion's in decline and secularism's on the rise. I think that the LDS Church's assets and net worth, like with Scientology, will continue to increase. So I'm not talking about their net worth and their bottom line. But I do believe the LDS Church will continue to experience significant decline in its growth rates, in its quantity and quality of membership over the next 50 years. But I am very hopeful for the Mormon people. And I'm very inspired by progressive and transitioning and post-Mormons and many faithful Mormons who are trying to do good in their own way while remaining in the church. There are many, many of these, and I don't mean to disparage them. I believe that untold greatness will emerge from this group of people and that they will take this moral desert and help it to blossom like a rose.
I'm in the same field as John, and the first thing I learned in graduate school was that the answer is always, it depends. It depends. Very frustrating for me. And the first year of grad school, I hated that answer, it depends. I don't want it to depend. I want you to give me a formula where I can know the answer. And I plug in these numbers, and out comes this answer, right? And that's not the way that it works when we're talking about people. When we're talking about human beings, it always depends. And now that I'm coming to the end of my program, I've embraced that answer fully, that it depends. And so that's my answer to the question, does the church do more harm or more good? Well, it depends, right? Much like what John said, it depends on who you are and what questions you're asking. So I want to talk about two categories initially. The Western kind of developed nations and developing nations. The function and the impact of the church are different when you compare those two groups, right? Also, I want to talk about another axis to think about is Maslow's hierarchy of needs. So, what do we know about hierarchy of needs, right? First, we have to take care of our physical bodies. We have to be safe. We have to have food. We have to have water. We have to have sleep. We have to have a place to live, right? And then we can move up the levels of hierarchy of needs until you get to self-actualization. And what that says to me is that there is going to be some access that is required for me to get to that place, okay? If I am constantly concerned with where am I going to sleep, what am I going to eat, will I be safe on my walk home from school or from work, will my children be safe and fed and all of those things, then I can't really, I don't have the opportunity or the access to think about more intellectual pursuits, mental challenges, right? So when I was chatting with Chris a little bit about my position, and he was trying to kind of get, you know, Misha, what are you gonna say? And I didn't make a presentation, and I don't have hard data. And so he was like, "Oh, I'm a little nervous." But what we talked about, I said, "Well, I'm gonna talk about kind of the body being liberated, but the mind being kind of shackled." And he said, "Okay, that'll be interesting. I don't know what that means, but it'll be interesting." I tried to assure him it'll be okay. So here's what I want to talk about. There are communities in our world, right? There are communities in our world where the only thing that you want for your child is to make sure that they are fed and safe and that they grow up to be productive members of society, right? And that's all, we all want that. Everybody wants that. However, that is harder for some people than it is for others. Most of us in this room, right, just pretty much can be sure. Our kids are going to grow up and, you know, they're going to be safe and they're going to probably go to college and get married and it'll be great and fine. We don't necessarily are concerned all the time with them securing the safety of their bodies. Now, that happens on occasion. But for most of us sitting in this room, that's not our main concern or worry. And that's called privilege, right? And we can see the different intersections where that privilege would be given to us or where we were born with that privilege, right? To be born in America, in a developing nation, right? That gives us that privilege. My family, my dad's side of the family, is from Bogalusa, Louisiana. And that is a very small town. It's a very segregated town. It's about 45 minutes outside of New Orleans. And it is a town that's just very impoverished. White people are poor there, black people are poor there, everyone's kind of poor there. And what I saw, what I have seen, when I have gone to visit my family, is that there is a safety in church. There's safety in church. Because if your kids are in church, they're not on the streets getting in trouble. And because, right, we're struggling financially, well, I can't be at home when my kids get home from school. That's a privilege to be able to be home when your kids get home from school. Often I'll hear black women say to me, "I don't understand what the white women are talking about all this, they want to work." They want to work. I've been working, and we have been working. We've been working two or three jobs. We've been working. I'd love to stay home and be a stay-at-home mom. Sign me up for that. Where's my man who's going to provide me with a comfortable life and an SUV and a four-bedroom house with a basement and food storage? Give me that, right? So we have these different fights, right? And so people in the town where my family is from, they want the kids in church. not in Mormon church. They don't want their kids in Mormon church. This is the very deep Bible Belt. But they want their kids in church because church secures their children's bodies while they can't be with their children. So is church doing more good for these people than not? I'd say, yeah, probably is, right? And I would say that that extends to Mormonism, and that extends when you're talking about communities all across the world, villages, right, where mothers are having to debate, my child can go to Young Men's and sit with benevolent patriarchs and learn how to not, how to treat their wife as a partner and be equally yoked with her, or to maybe get, you know, snatched up and recruited into some type of terrorist organization or some other terrible thing, child slavery type situation, right? Like, and this is real. This is happening, right? And so then we go, but you're going, Misha, what about imperialism? And I'm going, yeah, imperialism is terrible, right? But Mormonism didn't create imperialism. When I saw the Book of Mormon musical, I went with my best friend who's never been Mormon but grew up in Utah, and he was like, this is the best thing since sliced bread. I love this. Like, he just loved it because it was just smacking down the Mormons. And I was like, this isn't even about Mormons. It's not about Mormons. And he was like, what do you mean? And I said, it's about colonization. I said, we're just a pawn in this story. You can just tell this story through the lens of Mormonism very easily because we do it so prescriptively. The way that we colonize is so interesting and so funny, right? I mean, we're all dressed the same and we, you know, have this, you know, kind of sing-songy way that we do things, right? But we didn't invent this. We didn't invent colonization. So are we part of the problem? Yeah. Are we contributing to colonization? Yeah. I sat in a room with Elder Satati and I listened to him say that African saints are unbothered by the priesthood ban. And I was like, I gotta go. I was like, okay. I need to leave right now because this is something that is extremely, extremely troubling for me and for my Black Mormon friends. This is extremely troubling to us. This is something that people leave the church once they find out. This is something that once you start to grapple with is completely ugly. How can you say you're unbothered? How can you say that? It's offensive to me. And then I went, oh, wow. That's my privilege. Holy cow. To think that my oppression is my privilege, how does that work? Then that threw my whole paradigm shift off. And I was like, oh, gosh, my oppression is my privilege? What? Because I am in a privileged situation. I'm in academia. I sit around and I think about things all day, right? And I drive myself crazy. But I get to do that because my body, for most part, is secure. My body is safe and secure. And I have a food to eat and a roof over my head. And I know that if I wanted to buy something, I can buy it without really thinking much about it, right? Even as a poor graduate student, right? I have all of this privilege from being born in America and from being born in a middle-class family and from being born in a Mormon family. And so I get to be upset. I have the privilege of being upset and troubled by our history and by our practices and by our discrimination and by the things that we say. But I have to understand that that is a privilege because I have secured some of my needs in the hierarchy of needs. And folks who are like, I have community. I have, my children are safe. They're involved in good things. They're learning good principles. The church is relevant in other places more than it is relevant here because we have the things that we need. And so the relevance becomes different. And so again, it depends. Let's see how we're doing on time. It depends, right? So I want us to think about that idea that how is my privilege playing into this interpretation? So yes, I'm against imperialism and colonization, and I think that we have to do something about that. But no, did Mormonism create it, and are we the only ones perpetuating it? No. And at the same time as that's problematic and people's minds perhaps are not liberated, their bodies maybe are liberated. And here, our bodies, right, are safe, right, and are liberated, but maybe our minds are shackled because now we have to wrestle. Here in America, here us in this room, we're shackled because we have to wrestle with things that our privilege allows us to wrestle with. So I want us to think, as we go into the questions, how does it depend? Who am I, and how do I interact with this church? What's its impact on me, and what's its impact on other people, and how does it function? So that's all. I'll wrap up. Thanks.
All right, because we got started a little bit late, we have about 15 minutes for questions. Ryan, I know that you want to go after Stephen a little bit for some of the data, so I will unleash the dogs in just a second. But I also want to raise a philosophical question between the two of you in particular, because Ryan made the point that the church kills people and suggested that if the church kills one person, that's like a moral non-starter, that's a moral deal-breaker, whereas Stephen pointed out that there are health benefits for religion. And so this raises a question that's sort of a classic utilitarian dilemma. If you end somebody's life prematurely 15 years early, but at the same time you add a year to the lives of 20 other people, so you've got a net gain of 5 years of life, is that a calculation? Is that a net moral good? Is that a calculation that you can make? Or is the fact that you've killed somebody, is that a moral deal breaker? And so maybe that's something to just keep in mind as you guys engage here. But I will, if you have a question, please come to the mic. And I want to invite you guys first to ask a question of each other, if you have one, and then we'll go to the audience questions.
Let them ask questions.
Raise like 100 different issues.
Yeah. So,
go for it.
Ryan, you
turned on.
Yeah.
You seem to at the beginning express a
turn on your mic.
Mine's on.
Yeah.
Oh.
So I want you to self-critique very entertaining argument here. I can barely think of a human action or institution that could not equally be applied.
Catastrophic global warming. Wouldn't the planet be best off if we committed geo-homicide or suicide?
Nice.
Do you understand where I'm heading with this? Because if you think of every human action and every human institution, and we applied your argument that you've applied to the Mormon Church, isn't it best to simply have the human species disappear?
Okay. It's a fun argument, right? So you're taking the argument to its complete conclusion, right? Which I would actually say, no, the Mormon Church is very different from a lot of other institutions, right? Particularly when it comes to actually trying to change the world today. So that's part of where you're going with that, I'm assuming, the global climate change and stuff like that. Not all institutions are kind of teaching their people to believe demonstrably false things. In fact, there are plenty that don't do that. We would call that progressive Christianity, in fact, if you want to go that route. Many of them are fully accepting of the findings of science. As far as your argument, like, okay, let's just kill all humans because we're the ones causing the harm, right? Sure. We could do that, right? There's actually a social movement for this, voluntary human extinction movement. It's not very successful. Very few followers. Because very few people are signing up, right? But I totally get the argument. Sure, we could do that. I'm reminded of this quote from The Matrix, right? That humans are a virus. Sure, yeah. But are we really going to kill all of ourselves to solve the problem? I think there are other solutions. And in fact, there are some really simple solutions that are going to potentially solve the problem for us. So the increasing cost of kids is reducing the number of kids that people have, which is actually driving down population growth. And if current trends continue as they're expected, by 2100, we may have fewer people on the planet today than we do, fewer people on the planet than we do today, which is going to reduce the human impact on the environment, right? What is driving that? It's a lot of things, but part of it is the cost of kids. Is the Mormon Church following suit? To some degree, but as John pointed out, we're really good at producing more Mormons, right? And does that cause harm? Yeah, especially here in the U.S., where every single kid consumes about as much as, what is it, like 27 kids in India during the course of their lifetime. So having fewer kids here is not a bad idea, and there are forces that are driving that, but is the solution just to kill all ourselves? I mean, it's a great argument. It's a fun philosophical thought. It's kind of like Chris's philosophical thought about, you know, can we weigh that out? But is that really a solution? No, I don't think that's the solution. And I'm happy to talk more about this after, right? But what is the solution? Do we just wipe ourselves out? What's the point? Then we can't have these fun debates.
Yeah. Plus, one of the factors in whether something was good or bad was whether people were dying, so that would be considered net loss. But I was just thinking about, like, the first presentation. Like, there was so much information, and lots of us are far from the screen, so lots of information may have been lost because we're like, wait, how does it follow? But I'm wondering about this question of like, are you happy? And obviously, it's a very privileged question to ask, but I'm wondering, how could we even ask a Mormon the question? Like, that's pretty much like asking, like, should I be alive to a Mormon? You know, like, happiness is like a central part of your identity, whether you are happy or not. So that question, I think you did go into details, but I want to hear some people's opinions about that question as well as your opinion about that question. How can it be explored?
Yeah, sure. So yeah, that's a very good question. And actually, with this happiness question, they found that in certain some cultures, for example, I think they found this in Japanese culture, the happiness answer is deflated for cultural reasons because it's socially inappropriate for them to mark the highest happiness category because that's considered immodest or something like that. Anyway, so there's the possibility that we're seeing the same dynamic in Mormonism. I don't know. Like I said, there's a lot of speculation, but there's no, again, I haven't seen anything empirically. Again, probably just because we're not that interesting to study. But I haven't seen any evidence for it, but it might be. Sorry, for Ryan, it's very interesting to study. I shouldn't. So, yeah, it's a possibility. I haven't seen any evidence for it. But, yeah, it varies a lot from country to country, and there's been volumes and volumes on this because they've asked this question around the world to get at this question of which countries are the happiest countries and is economic development associated with happiness. And so in order to get to that point, you have to come to this consensus that happiness means the same through every culture. And that's not clear that that's the case, but that would take too much work to figure out, so they just kind of assume that anyway. But so anyway, yeah, that's the answer. It's like there have been times that have been shown that it is inflated or deflated for certain cultures. Maybe Mormonism is one of those. I don't know.
Can I respond? Yeah. So the happiness one, I have to kind of just talk about this. So one thing, going back directly to the question, we've actually found that religious people have a response bias. So they're more likely to have response bias when they're answering questions, which presents themselves in a more positive light. So going right back to your question saying, like, can you ask Mormons if they're happy? Of course they're going to say yes. Turns out religious people are more likely to say yes. But the question gets complicated in a lot of different ways. So Diener, who Stephen mentioned earlier, is a very well-known scholar who studies subjective well-being, and he's been looking at this for a long time, and he finally realized, hey, we don't find the same relationship between religiosity and happiness in Europe that we do here in the U.S. And he finally started to ask, well, why is that? What's going on? And it turns out the explanation's pretty straightforward. In countries where religion is normative, where people expect people to be religious and it's kind of expected that you be religious, religious people are happier. But in countries where it's not normative, there's no difference in happiness, right? And I think you can illustrate this very, very simply using Utah as a good example. If you're an ex-Mormon living in Utah, how happy are you going to be? You're surrounded by Mormons.
On Sundays, you're super happy.
Fair enough. John wins. But it goes right back to the point, right? When you're constantly surrounded by people who are berating who you are, who are belittling who you are, who are telling you that you're inferior because you left the religion, how happy are you really going to be? So in countries where non-religious people or less religious people or ex-Mormons are actually being frowned upon, they're shamed, they're stigmatized, they're less happy. And that's been shown over and over again. So we have really good data, actually, just in the last 5 years that's shown this. And if you email me, I'll send you the articles, right? Because there are a number of articles that have come out just in the last 5 years showing that's what's explaining that tiny, tiny, tiny happiness gap that exists in the U.S. And that's another point that I wanted to make, if I can take just one more second. Yes, there is a statistically significant difference in happiness between the religious and the non-religious in the U.S., but you have to think about difference between statistical significance and meaningful significance. You mentioned, what was it, like 0.1%, right? I mean, it's like this tiny, insignificant amount. Just because it's statistically significant doesn't mean it means anything, right? So, okay, maybe they're statistically significantly happy, but practically, there's no difference.
I just want just a tangent point, but I just want to say that one possible exception to what Ryan said about being a transitioning your post or ex-Mormon here in Utah is that there are more transitioning and post-Mormons here in Utah. I actually know some people who traditionally have hated Utah, have never wanted to live in Utah, but because they've transitioned out of the church, the people that they feel most comfortable being around are other post-Mormons, and where are there more post-Mormons than here? And so as we see with sort of the Mormon Spectrum website and all the face-to-face communities that are popping up with the Oases branches that are popping up, five of them now across Utah, what we're seeing is that this is a wonderful place to be post-Mormon, because you can make some of the best friendships and relationships that you'll ever make in your life.
It also occurs to me, Ryan, that given your rational choice argument, there may be some self-selection in the sense that the people who aren't happy being Mormon are removing themselves from the survey sample.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, hi. I'll be quick. I understand that the point of this panel is to be kind of descriptive. You were given a question to answer, and you described, like, one way or the other, or both sides. But I also think about how the people in the room are receiving this information, what they do with it, that people who already came in thinking that it's harmful are being like, oh, yeah, that's right, like, I totally agree with these guys, and vice versa. So I was wondering if anybody would mind taking like a kind of prescriptive, give a prescriptive answer, like, what do we do with this information? What's useful about knowing the harm and good that the church does?
I'm an ivory tower academic who doesn't care. So I'm going to bow out and give it to John.
This answer may be a cop-out, but I deal with clients all the time who are still faithful, still believing, and people who have left. And it will surprise maybe some people to find out that I do not encourage people to leave the church, and I don't consider people to stay in the church. I think what we can be really safe about is to encourage people to start paying more attention to their thoughts and their feelings and their own experiences. And if somebody's finding joy in the church, if in your personal experience you're finding joy and meaning and fulfillment and community and satisfaction in the church, then it probably makes sense that you stay. But when it comes to certain populations where the church becomes a toxic influence, and I'll just say, my study of 1,612 LGBT Mormons, we found that 70% of our sample left the church. And we actually did a study with very high effect sizes that showed that the farther distance away the LGBT people got from the church, the higher quality of life, the lower the depression, the higher the self-esteem, the lower sexual identity distress. So literally, active Mormons who are LGBT had quality of life ratings lower than those who have lupus. And then they got a little bit of a benefit in quality of life if they went inactive, and then they got a little bit more if they were disfellowshipped. And then those who were excommunicated or had resigned from the church had the highest quality of life, the highest self-esteem, the lowest sexual identity distress, the lowest, pick your variable. And I think if you're LGBT, you probably just have to pay attention to what it feels like to be at church to realize it's probably toxic for you. And maybe those of us who are non-believing can do a better job of not trying to inflict our bias on believers and tell them that what's good for them is to leave, because we don't know that. And by the same token, maybe those of us who are believers can stop pressuring people to stay and believe if they decide for themselves that the church isn't healthy for them. That'd be my answer.
I'll ditto as the other therapist. Good. To what John said. Right? Like, it has to be, we can't tell people what their journey needs to look like or what their path needs to look like. And there's incredibly horrible, toxic, terrible things about the United States of America, and we all can't leave it, sadly. But, you know, people are like, don't you just want to, like, do you ever just want to, like, leave? And I'm like, no, my people built this country. No, I don't. I'm not going anywhere. Like, I'm going to stay, and I'm going to try to improve it where I can. And so that's going to be some people's journey. And some people says, I am going to leave. I'm, you know, metaphorically moving to Canada, right? And that's an answer for some people. So let's be gentle with ourselves and gentle with our friends as everyone's going on their paths and their journeys.
Unfortunately, we're at the end of our time here. Is it a quick question?
Just a quick comment, actually.
Okay, super quick.
I just wanted to add my two cents about the comment you actually had at the beginning of the questions with the health, the physical health, with which if it was better to have a net gain of 20 over just a single 15-year gain. I think looking at that, you'd have to consider that the person who takes their life 15 years before they would have died naturally, had a quality of life that was much less than perhaps those people who died of natural causes a year less. So I think that would need to be taken into consideration in that.
Well, I want to thank our panelists. I know there are some sharp disagreements on the panel, but I think you guys modeled civil debate for us, and that's what this is all about. So thank you, everyone, for coming, and thank you to our panelists.